Okay, we are now recording the audio. It will get posted later on along with the presentation decks. Welcome. We have quite a few questions already in the queue, but if anybody has additional questions, by all means, you can ask them in the chat or unmute yourself later on and ask the question live if you want. I don't think I have anything in the way of announcements that need to go out or anything like that, so I will turn it over to Alan to lead us through the deck for tonight.
Thanks, Chris. Welcome, everyone. As Chris mentioned, we do have quite a lot of material tonight, I think, so we'll boogie on through some of this stuff. I'm starting off with a follow-up on a discussion we had a week or two ago on gaming computers and what we might recommend. This was the outcome of my great nephew. He bought himself an Asus laptop. It has a Core i7, that's a 10th generation processor, 2.6 gigahertz with a 5 gigahertz turbo, got 16 gig of DDR4 RAM, a 1 terabyte SSD, a gaming graphics card, fairly good quality. I mean, the sky's the limit on those things, I think. High definition 15.6 monitor, tons of USB ports, and you notice it has lots of pretty lights, as I say. Customizable LEDs, and that's what you get for your lousy $1,600 these days. Now, that's Canadian, so actually not a bad price for those specs, I think.
Yeah, that's pretty good.
This, on the personal front, I've got a 27-inch monitor, and it's a used monitor, and I find that the whites have a distinct pink cast to them. So my question was, how can I change the color balance? And it turns out that there's a Windows display calibration tool, if you can find it. I tried things like display calibration and color calibration. Color calibration works, actually. If you put, you notice in the search bar here, I put color cal, and it finds the calibrate display color tool, which is a Windows tool. So you load that guy up, and you can change things like gamma and brightness and contrast and the color balance, which is what I want to do.
Yeah, just like there, Alan, I forgot to mute all, so I'm going to mute all, and you can unmute yourself now. Sorry about that.
So you've got all these things that you can change, and I'm interested in particular in the color balance. This guy right here. It turns out you have to go through the whole gamut of these things. So you load up the program, and you notice it says there's a link here. How do I calibrate my display? And that takes you to a Microsoft web page with like frequently asked questions, none of which, as far as I can see, tell you anything about color displays. So I would avoid that. And then you get into a series of adjustment screens. So here it's trying to tell you what the good gamma looks like in the middle here. If the gamma's too low, the circle will be lighter. And if the gamma's too high, the little circle will be darker. So you go to the next here, and now my problem was I couldn't remember what the good thing looked like and the bad thing looked like, but there's no back arrow, so you can't go backwards at this point. The other thing was, when I changed the slider here right down to the bottom, it didn't really change the display very much. So these changes must be fairly subtle, I think. As you will see now, we have to, this is the color balance when we get to it, and we're trying to make these grays kind of gray rather than purples and greens and browns and things. And so again, you can go to next, and you see that you've got red, green, blue sliders. So there's the original color balance. And if I change the red slider to like 50%, you notice there's a huge difference. Or maybe you don't notice a huge difference, because I can't see a huge difference. And then you can look at the final screen, and you can go switch between the previous calibration and the current calibration. And again, to my eye, maybe it's my vision, I don't know, but they don't look a whole lot different. And then you get a series of eye charts. There are five of these things, and it asks you to pick the one that looks the sharpest. And almost all of them look the same to me. I guess there are some, again, subtle differences. I'm not convinced that I've got rid of my red cast in the whites particularly. Anyway, if anybody's got any other bright ideas for how to change the color balance on a monitor, send me an email.
Yeah, I'll mention most monitors, if you actually go into the settings on the monitor itself, you can do various adjustments, and typically people will adjust brightness and contrast and things like that. But you can often go in and change gamma and color balance, or, you know, sometimes they're blunt instruments. You can set it to, you know, for movies or for vivid or various things like that. On some monitors, higher end ones, you can actually set it to whether it's the sRGB color space or the Adobe RGB color space, and it'll just sort of set everything to it. So that's something that you can always try as well, is see if the controls on the monitor itself can do something for you.
Yeah, okay, thanks.
Okay. Yeah, Bob Rocker here. A few years ago, I bought a new big screen TV, and included in the package was the calibration. And the way they work it is that they want you to use the TV for a couple months and get it settled in. And then they send Buddy to the house who uses various instruments to set the color balance correctly. And generally speaking, when you go into the store like Best Buy or whatever, out of the factory, most of the TVs and laptops and monitors are set with the blue balance quite a bit higher than normal. Because it makes the colors pop, makes the screen pop. When you're sitting there in a showroom with like 50 or 60 or 70 TVs side by side playing the same thing, everybody wants their TV to pop the most. So they really skew the color balance away from what's natural. And I noticed after the calibration was done, I'd be using my laptop as the source for the programming to my TV. And on the TV screen, compared to what the laptop screen showed, the TV screen was a lot more browns, whereas the laptop screen just popped with more blues. And so I looked into what the deal is with calibrating your computer, and I came across a device which you basically put over top of the laptop screen, and it monitors what's going on. You play some software, and it manages to balance it all. The device is like about $400 at the time, and I didn't figure it was worth it. But the factory color balance on almost any type of screen is not really natural, and getting it to where it should be natural isn't a casual exercise. And this also goes for your printers. There's techniques for calibrating the printers so the printers print what's natural as opposed to what makes the printers look good. So it's a bit of a mug's game there.
Yeah, it can be done if you want to get into calibration of the monitor more exactly. Spider has one, SPYDER, and X-Rite has another color calibration. And I think for the most part, the basic packages are, and this is the hardware device you hang over your monitor and it does its thing. They start, I think, at about 250 or 300 Canadian, then deluxe packages can add a couple of $100 to that. But I don't need things calibrated to that extent, so I'm not interested in actually trying it. But a lot of photographers really swear by them.
Yeah, Spider was a device that I looked at, and as you say, they got their basic model, and the prices go up for $200 to $300, and the prices go up from there.
Yeah.
Okay, next is a progress report from Chris on his activity in switching service providers.
Okay, I'm going to take over the screen here for just a minute. Won't be long. I recently went through switching internet service provider, and because we talked about it briefly at one of the recent Q&As, I decided that it might be of interest to other people to see what I went through. My old situation, I was with TechSavvy on cable internet, so I was using Rogers infrastructure, and I was getting 30 megabit per second download, 5 megabit per second upload. That's what I was paying for, and that's what I got very, very close to that, with unlimited bandwidth, and it was $50 a month, and it's going up next month to $60. Just on the other things, because it comes into bundling afterwards, I had Rogers TV, I had basic high-def package, I owned my own PVR, and it would store about 100 hours of high-def, and I was paying $55 a month for that. And I had a Bell landline, pretty basic, I had call display, but I had no long-distance package or any other features or anything like that, and that was $54 a month. So considering that going next month, going up to $60 for TechSavvy, that comes to $169 a month. That's quite a lot of money. So what was bugging me overall, it was a lot of money. I have an awful lot of inertia when it comes to things like this. Something has to bug me an awful lot before I'll get off my butt and actually check out what's available and see if I can do better. The thing that really got me off my butt was TechSavvy raising the price by 20%. And that came about because of CRTC ruling that Bell and Rogers would be able to charge more to use their infrastructure. It is interesting to note that a year or two ago, TechSavvy actually had a drop in price because of a CRTC ruling that Rogers and Bell were not going to be able to charge more. And I think they lowered my price by about 1%. So I get a lowering of 1% and I get a raising of 20%.
Just a note on that, Chris. Nishleen put a post on the members forum that there's been a recent federal court decision, an appeals court decision, turning down that Bell thing. Whether that's going to affect the price eventually or not, I don't know. It'll probably go to the Supreme Court next.
Yeah, and the trouble is the government still is of the mind that they want to let the Bell and Rogers and them charge more for their infrastructure. And so I think it's going to go back to the government making the decision, and that doesn't look promising at this point in time. So I looked around a little bit. The best deal I could find was with Rogers, and I did a bundle. And for internet, I could get 150 megabit per second down and 15 megabit per second up with unlimited bandwidth. Ignite TV with 49 channels, which I think was more than I had before. It included 5 flex channels, which allowed me to pick up some other channels that I didn't get before, such as the movie network and the sci-fi channel and a couple of things like that. At cloud PVR, so it's all stored on Rogers infrastructure and just download it over whenever you want to watch something, and it gives you 200 hours, so about twice the storage that I had on my own PVR. And they actually throw in home phone as a no-cost add-on. So if you don't want home phone, you don't get it any cheaper, but you get unlimited Canada-wide calling, which I didn't have with Bell, and it had 7 calling features, most of which I probably actually won't use. And I could get all of that for $130 a month. Until I actually, that's the price I got off of their website. So when I went to order it, I was told, oh no, that's for new people only. And you're going to have to pay more. And I think it was an extra 15 or 20 bucks a month more. And I argued vehemently that they shouldn't be treating their existing customers so shabbily that they won't give them the best deal. And so the person there decided that, well, what we can throw you a bone with is we'll give you $25 off per month for a year. And so then that would bring it down to $105 a month for 12 months. When I got my first bill, it actually is being billed at $130 a month, and I'm getting the $25. And so I presume after 12 months, it is going to go up to the $130 rather than the $145 or whatever I was quoted before. And so now I'm down to $105 a month for the next 12 months, which is kind of nice. So my final tally, on the internet side, I'm getting 300 megabit per second, even though I'm only paying for 150. And when the installer came out and they just hang around outside and they do some things on the wiring going into my house, he didn't seem to be at all surprised that I was getting 300 megabit per second. So I think that they just give that to everybody so that nobody complains if there are slowdowns. But that's 10 times what I'm getting with TechSavvy. And every time I've checked it, I've been getting about 290 to 297 megabits per second. So really good, 10 times what I'm getting on TechSavvy. On the upload side, I am getting the 15 megabit per second that I was promised, and that's 3 times what I was getting on TechSavvy. TV, I'm getting more channels. I'm getting a better PVR. I get a remote that has voice control, so I can say, you know, skip forward 4 minutes to jump over commercials and things like that. Again, do searching on things just by voice and so forth. Kind of nice. And on the phone, I gained Canada-wide calling, and I got more calling features, which I probably won't use, all for $39 a month less. And for the next 12 months, it's actually $64 a month less. So what my cautionary tale, I guess, in all of this is that the prices change radically, almost day to day, it seems. Various providers, one will be ahead 1 month, one will be ahead the other month. Generally speaking, I think that Rogers is better than Bell in the pricing, but you have to check it out. And you have to be willing to argue with them on the phone that, no, this isn't what it should cost, and you should be paying less. And quite often, they will at least throw you a bone of for the next 12 months, they'll give you a bit of a deal or something like that. And just a note that my cell phone, I didn't bother changing. Rogers was not interested in giving me a special deal if I brought my phone over to them, mobile over to them as well. So they said, no, you just go on the website. Our prices there for mobile is what you would end up paying. So I'm with Virgin Mobile, which gives me unlimited text, countrywide calling, 4 gigabytes a month of data for $50 a month, which I think is pretty good, and I don't think anybody else is really matching it at this point in time, so I'm sticking with that. And that's it.
This is a question from Ollie. It's just moved off the screen here. What do you use as an answering machine or answering service?
Yeah, they do have call answer on that as one of the calling features. However, I haven't even bothered setting it up. I have a cordless phone set that I use in my home that includes an answering machine, and I actually prefer to just have it local. And that way, when the person calls in, I usually don't answer my phone. My message actually says I don't answer the phone. If you're not a telemarketer or some charity looking for money, please leave a message and I'll get back to you. And if I'm around, I'll listen as they're recording a message if they are not a telemarketer. And if it's somebody I know, I can pick it up. If I do the calling feature through Rogers, that all will be done in the background, and I'll have to call in to check it. Apparently, I can actually get messages turned into text and emailed to me, so I may actually look into that. I notice also there's another question here about the checking messages remotely. From the local answering machine, no, but I can check it through voice, or as I said, I think there's a way of getting it sent as a text. And then cordless phones won't work with no power either, yeah. The internet home phone, it is VoIP. If I am without power, I'm going to lose it. I don't really care. I don't use my home phone very much at all. And so if I lost it, it wouldn't bother me. I have my cell. But if that is a concern, if that's your only line, then yes, you will lose it if you don't have power.
Yeah, Bob Walker here. Several months ago, I gave a mini presentation on the VoIP telephones, and my own base station, cordless phone base station, takes messages for me, and it'll handle two lines, but in the event of a power failure, because I'm out here in rural Ottawa, where such things are very common, I have my internet modem, the cordless base station, my cell phone repeater, and several other items hooked up to an uninterruptible power supply. So, you know, during a power failure, everything keeps working. And if the power failure is going to be of any length, I have the option of starting up the generator and plugging everything into it, which is a bit of a pain, but the white phone service, which gives me unlimited Canada-wide calling and all sorts of calling features, including voicemail, comes to $5.10 a month. And that's through UMA, which you might have seen advertised on TV and which is in my presentation, which should be somewhere on the website, OPCUB website somewhere.
Yeah, I think it's on the history list for past presentations.
Okay, so we'll move back to the main presentation here. And you should be seeing a question about a PC that's running Windows 10, but the user doesn't know if they're using Windows Mail. What's a web browser? And to get to email, I Google for hotmail.com and follow the prompts. The inbox reads 20,364, which she thought meant they weren't opened. Can you explain how can I use a web browser to log on to Outlook and delete my mail? Chris?
Yeah, I had a couple of, when I got this email came into suggestion box at opcug.ca, I needed a little bit more information because it depends on how you're normally accessing your mail, because I thought one possibility would be if they were using something like the Windows 10 Mail app or Thunderbird or something like that as a POP or IMAP mailer. Basically, it's going out to the service provider's mailbox, downloading them to your computer, and then you interact with them locally. So there's that is one way of accessing mail, and that can cause you problems with a huge number of messages in your inbox, because if you use POP3 in particular, you can set it so that it downloads your mail, but it never deletes it from the server. And so they just continue to collect on the server until you get nasty messages from the service provider saying that, you know, you're out of space on your mailbox, and you might look at your local copy. You might have five messages, and you go, well, what's happening? Well, that can happen. In this case, it wasn't the case because the person is actually using a web browser to access their mail. And there is that confusion between Outlook.com and Hotmail. Hotmail was bought by Microsoft and eventually rebranded as Outlook.com. And so if you have a Hotmail account or if you go to Hotmail.com, you end up at Outlook.com. And so on the screen right now, you see a screenshot of Outlook.com, and this is the normal sort of setup for it. Sometimes the part where you see under Happy Woman's Day, that's a preview of the message that is highlighted in the next column to the left. Sometimes you won't have that. So that is an option that you can turn on or off. You might just see that second column from the left where it's just the message and you don't see a preview of the message as you click on it. And in that case, you just have to click on each message to have it open up to read it. But that's normally what you'll see. And then in the left-hand column, you'll see where it says inbox and it has 17 beside it. Well, that's 17 unread messages. So I presume that what this person is running into is that they have actually, you know, 20,000 odd messages that are unread. And if you go over into that next column, where it shows who the message is from, the subject, and the start of the message itself, you would end up with a list of some 20 odd thousand messages. How to deal with them then is another question. Now, if the person who actually sent in this question, if you're, are you on the line? And if so, can you unmute yourself?
Here I am.
Okay. All right. Now, are you willing to actually share your screen? Because what we could do is, you know, if you have nothing sensitive in it, we could actually look at what you are seeing and perhaps direct you to, you know, how you would go about doing that.
I would need to be told how I can.
Yep. Okay. So down at the bottom of the Zoom meeting window, do you see a toolbar? And if you don't see a toolbar, just move your mouse down towards the bottom of that screen, the Zoom meeting, and you should see mute, stop video, security, participants, chat, and there in the middle, there should be a green button saying share screen. Do you see that?
Oh, I do.
Okay, if you click on that, it should then bring up a window where the top left option will be to share your screen. And if you...
It says here, host disabled.
Oh, okay, hang on, sorry. Yeah, just a second then. Let me just go and, sorry. Okay, you're coming in here as owner, okay.
I don't know how to change that either.
Yeah, it doesn't really matter, but what I'm going to do is I'm going to make you a co-host right now. Okay, so you should now be able to click on the share screen.
Okay.
And then the top left one will say something like screen or something like that.
It does.
Okay, click on that, and then in the bottom right-hand corner, you have to click on the button that says share. Okay, yeah, I think that's it. Yes, okay. So now go and bring up your mail as you normally would. Yeah, okay, so I think you have it in a tab on there, right? Your second tab from the left is mail.
Well, I usually get to my mail by that Google something.
Okay, I think you already had it open, but you can go ahead and open another one. That's fine. So however you go, do you get to your mail?
Okay.
Actually, if you look right at the top of your screen, you have four tabs open in the browser there. The second one is, yeah, I think that. If you click on that, there you go. Okay, so if you scroll that bar to the top, yeah, that's where you see the 19,000. Oh, you're down to 19,594 messages in your inbox.
I took off 755 today, so.
Okay. Now, to me, there's a couple of ways. If you hover over, just as an example, the circle that is beside Nick Pelosi, the first message in the second list.
Yes.
Yeah. If you click on that, you see how you've now selected that message. So then, if you click on the delete at the top of the screen, it would allow you to delete it. Now, another, you can go through and each message, you can select them. And then
like that, like click on it.
Yeah, and then it's selected.
And then if you wanted to,
you click on delete. Now you see how all of the circles have now gone to open. So once you've selected one, you can then just click on other circles to select them.
Okay.
And then you just click on the delete at the top. Now, if you wanted, because you've got so many, do you know if there's perhaps only a few that you want to keep and all the rest go, or?
I'm the type of person who would have to, it would take some debating to actually.
Yeah. Okay, that's going to be the tedious thing for you is going through those 19,000. But that's the way you would do them is just select one of the circles, and then you could go down the list and select other open circles, and then once you've got all of the ones that you want to delete checked, then you would click off the delete at the top of the screen.
Now, this row here, if I hit this one.
Yeah.
And.
So that's mail, yep.
Okay. And this one here.
That's your calendar. So Outlook includes calendaring capabilities in it, as well as some task management and some things like that.
Okay. Now, if I don't want to be in this spot,
So go back to down at the bottom left, you have mail again. So you could click on the envelope, and that'll get you back to your mail.
Perfect. Okay.
Chris, one of the options in that list of mail is filter. Is it possible to do it by date order or something and get rid of all the 2017 emails, for example?
Yeah, I don't know, actually. There's, in the top right-hand corner, there's a gear icon. I'm not sure if there's anything under the gear that will let you do something like that.
Well, the filter's in the second column right now.
Oh, yeah, that's true. Yeah. Yeah, if you click at the top of the list of the messages themselves, you see there's focused, other, and filter. If you click on filter.
I do not see that. Where is?
Yeah, in the second column at the top where it says focused, other, filter. If you click on filter. Okay, so. Yeah, you could show all unread and then just do a select all and get rid of them if you wanted to. You could sort and you could say sort by date probably. Yeah, so it is sorted by date. So then you could go to the end of your messages and just say, well, if it's 5 years old, do I really care about it? Yeah, but I mean, fundamentally, you're going to have to come to the decision about how you're going to decide what can get deleted and what can't. And I think it's going to be a rather tedious process under the best of circumstances.
A couple of things in chat. Karen suggesting that you could filter by sender and then choose to delete in bulk by sender. And she's found that helpful.
Yeah, that could be a good idea, especially for marketing emails and things like that.
Mm-hmm.
You know, if you get, and even if it's like CBC News, well, if you sort by sender and you just select, you know, the entire chunk of CBC News messages, that would be one thing you could do. Another thing that might work, and this would probably be really useful when you sort by sender, try clicking on, just as an example, Brian Vasily, the top message there. Now, hold down the shift key and click on, say, my message from yesterday.
Okay, this one here?
Hold down the shift key and click it.
Now, is the shift key the one that makes the capitals?
Yep.
Okay, so I've got that, and then hit your message.
And then click it. Yeah, so that's the way you could select a chunk of messages, so that would be very useful in the context of, saying, sorting by sender. And then, like I said, if you had lots of messages from, say, CBC News, you could go to the first one, and then click on the first one, go to the last one, hold shift, click it, it'll select all of them, then you could hit the delete.
So I could do that with the, I have many, many old Ottawa Citizen.
Yeah.
So I could do that with the Ottawa Citizen.
Perfect. Yep, because they'll all be from the same address, so, yeah.
Now, how do I not lose all the ones that I've clicked to go? Do I?
I think if you just click another message, it probably will deselect all of them. Try clicking on Nick Pelosi.
I still have it down, so.
Yeah, that's fine.
I'll let go of the shift key.
Pardon?
You can let go of the shift key now.
And they won't disappear?
No, they won't disappear as long as you don't hit delete or anything like that.
Okay.
Try just clicking on, actually.
That message you have right there.
That's probably just going to toggle that one off. I'm not sure how to get out of the toggle mode. Actually, I know one way you could deselect them all. Up at the top, right to the left of where it says focused, there's a checkbox. If you click on that, it'll select all of them.
Yes.
Click once on it. And now click it again. And that deselects
them. And that worked, yes.
Yeah.
Okay.
And then further to that comment, is that if you search for Ottawa Citizen, and then Chris beat me to it. I was just going to put it into a chat, and then I thought better to verbalize it. If you do a search on Ottawa Citizen, for example.
Yeah, that probably will work well as well.
Okay.
There we go. So if you click on the second entry there, there you go. So now if you wanted to get rid of all of those, you could click the check mark beside results at the top.
But you see, Okay. Well,
yeah. So what you would have to do is you would have to select those items. Though, interestingly, it's pulling from her deleted items, too, which is not a behavior I see in the traditional Outlook. Interesting.
Yeah, and you're also getting Ottawa Citizen as being part of a body of a message. That's why it probably would be better to use the filter and sort by sender and then be able to do it.
Okay, this is great. Thank you.
Okay, so I think
before you move on, the other thing is, in the deleted items, there are 755 messages, so you might want to talk about that.
I did that yesterday after I spoke with Chris. I went to delete here somewhere, and what I did was I deleted items, and there was, I had 3,500, and when I went to that spot, when I hit to delete the 3,500, it said I also had another 4,500. So yesterday, I deleted 7,500.
Yeah.
And then today, I went through some, it doesn't matter. But anyway, these are the newest ones, and I will go back later, and I will do the same thing and take them and take these out, because the last time it was showing me I had 3,500 deleted, but I had more that were not there. So anyway, they're gone forever. Thank you.
Okay, I think we've got a start for you. If you wanted to, you've got my email address. Feel free to contact me, and we could do a one-on-one like this again if you wanted to, and we could go into some more detail and try some other things. But I think that we should probably move along with the Q&A at this point in time. But yeah, feel free to touch base with me, and we could do a one-on-one on that.
How do I get rid of the mail and just have your screen on?
Okay, I think that probably, just because we are running on time, how about we take that up as a one-on-one? So if you contact me.
Chris wants to see the presentation, Chris.
So. Oh, seeing the presentation. Okay, well, I'm gonna do the stop sharing, and then you will have down at the bottom of the screen, you see that the Zoom icon is the one on the right. Yeah, if you just click on that, and actually, Alan, if you just take over sharing.
Yeah.
So now you should be able to see the Zoom controls map. And I'm going to take away your co-owner.
Oh, that's even better. Oh, there I am. Okay, I shall mute.
Okay, Alan, onward.
Okay, so another question that came in was somebody who's imported files from an old computer and needs to find out whether information is useful or not. And in particular, she has a bunch of WordPerfect files. So, but she doesn't have the program. She has a WordPerfect document, but she doesn't have the WordPerfect program. So one solution there is to use a different word processor. And for example, LibreOffice, the free Office package, and their version of word processor is called Writer, and it has the ability to open WordPerfect files and Microsoft Word and all kinds of other things. So that's an alternative, is to use a different word processor and to access your old files. Now, another question was about backup.
Just before you move on, I'll point out that if you open it in LibreOffice, you could then save it as a Word document or something like that as well. So you can convert your files if you wanted.
But, okay, a quick question. If you go back that one slide, Alan.
It said it was for the Mac.
No, go back one more. If some of the information is no longer needed, so isn't part of the question being that they no longer need the files and therefore they want to delete them?
I guess, but don't you need to know what's in it before you delete it?
If the person identifies them as being the old WordPerfect files and no longer cares about them, he or she could search by extension, which, if memory serves me, is WPD, and then delete all dot star dot WPD, either using File Explorer or command line DOS if they feel either way. But all I'm saying is that if they want to delete files that have a certain extension, they could do it through a mass delete by once they search it. Pick your way of searching for them.
Sure. Bob Walker here. If Word itself will open WordPerfect files if you have it set that way. But an easier way might be to use a there's a number of format converting programs, some of them free, like Doxillion, which will do a bulk. Take all your WordPerfect files and turn them into Word files, and then you can use Word to go through them one at a time to see if you still want the file, and if not, delete it.
This is Karen Wallace-Grainer. I'm the one that submitted the question, and thank you, Bob. Could you provide the name of that converting program again?
Yeah, the particular one I actually just last week I'm trying to sort out some of my really old files, and I have a whole bunch of old WordPerfect files, and I looked on the internet, and the file name or the program I came across, there's a number that where you can do it online, which means you have to upload the file and then download the conversion. But this one, you can just download the software, and it'll do bulk conversion. It's called Doxillion. That's Doxillion.
Bob, I just pasted into the chat window the Microsoft Store location where you can download it. So if you're on Windows 10, you can hit the link in the chat, and that will take you to where you can download the program that will do that conversion for free.
That's awesome. Thanks.
Okay. Next question is about saving backups. I think this might be Karen, too. She's got a whole raft of backups, but she doesn't know whether she can delete them because, you know, what happens if one of them has something that the other one doesn't? But she has a 4 terabyte external drive, which is filling up because she doesn't know which ones to delete. So everybody can chip in on this in a second, but my strategy is to have I have a current backup of my working data files, and I keep that up to date every time I run a computer session. I just do a free file sync and synchronize my hard drive data partition to the USB flash drive, so that keeps those current. I have an automatic system which does a daily incremental backup of the data files, and that goes into a different hard drive on my system. And then I have a monthly full system image backup, which I store on an external USB drive, which is essentially what Karen's doing. I tend to keep the monthly backups for about a year, and then I cut them down to every quarter. After 3 years, I kind of give up, because by that time, I think the operating system's been updated so many times and the applications have been updated so many times, I'm probably never going to go back to a three-year-old disk image. And any data that I have, I've archived onto various USB drives in multiple copies. So I've got everything fairly well covered, I think. So that's my situation. What about everybody else? What do people think about how you manage multiple backup systems? And remember, you have to unmute or put something in the chat.
Yeah, Bob Walker here. A little while back, I bought a Western Digital MyBook Duo, which is basically two identical hard drives in the same housing, and you can set it up to mirror each other. So if one of the drives goes south, you can just pull it out, put a new one in, and the surviving one copies everything back over. And I started going through all my old backups, all my old USB drives, all my USB keys and everything else. And I've set up a directory that I call master. And so in that master directory, I have things like, you know, here's pictures, or here's music, or here's videos or whatever. And I just start loading everything in, as I go through the various drives. And I've established, you know, here's my master music directory here. And as I'm copying stuff over from other drives, I have a directory called to sort. And then when I get a chance, I take it from to sort and file it away into various, you know, things like here's Fleetwood Mac and ZZ Top or whatever else. And gradually sort of work my way through and get rid of all the old, you know, and then erase all the old ones. And from time to time, I copy this MyBook Duo to another USB hard drive just as a backup to the backup. But I'm slowly going through all my old sources of data and all my old computers and laptops and everything else, and gradually going to get sorted out down to what I need.
And that's basically what Lawrence is suggesting in the chat window. Buy more drives. Storage is relatively cheap. Yeah. And again, go through the backups or buy more storage.
Yeah, but at some point you want to sort of sort things out so you get it down to here's what I need to keep and here's what I can get rid of. And the vast majority is here's what I can get rid of, or here's duplicates of duplicates of duplicates, and get it sorted out. And the nice thing about this is if you're doing it on a laptop, you can be sitting there watching some mindless TV show and be doing this in the background. In the same way, I've got far too many CDs, and all the music I've acquired over the last several years has been electronic. So every once in a while, I just grab a fistful of CDs as I'm watching TV, put them through a CD or DVD player, a USB one plugged into my laptop, and convert them into MP3s. And then I can get rid of the physical CDs, and then I have the files in MP3 or any other format that I can, you know, then burn onto a USB stick and play in my car or wherever else.
One rule of thumb I have for backups is that any important file should be in at least three places. So it should be live on your main computer, a local backup, and then an offsite backup. And
I agree with Chris 100% on that. You never want to, you know, put all your eggs in one basket.
Yeah.
Always have a backup to the backup to your backup.
Yeah. The local backup is good because like I have mine plugged in all the time into my computer because I have incremental backups run every night. And so because it's attached to my system all the time, if I happen to get hit with something like a file encrypting malware or something like that, it could encrypt not only my live files but also my backup set. And so for that, as well as be able to recover from a fire or theft or a major electrical problem or something like that, I have my offsite backup, which I usually run about every month. And so, you know, if I do get into that serious problem, I might lose up to a month's worth of stuff. And that's the risk that I've decided for me I'm willing to take for just the convenience of only doing that offsite backup once a month.
Go ahead.
This is Karen speaking. Thank you all. This is really excellent feedback. And Chris, I did attend one of your library sessions on backup, but it was years ago. And I guess my thing now is that I probably have had a new computer in the time when I took that course to now. And I'm just wondering what programs to use. I'm using the built-in Windows backup one, but I'm not convinced that that's the right way to go. And the 4 terabyte that I just ended up buying for exactly the reason that one of the other men said is because my other storage was running low, and now this thing's almost full, and I can't believe it that it's filled up that fast. And I'm just wondering. And also, I sent Alan a screenshot earlier today about how it's doing the backup, and I'm not actually even convinced it's doing the backup or what it's actually doing, because when I go in and take a look at the image that it's creating, it asks me if I actually want to go through the process. No, I don't. I just want to see where it is and what it's doing. So I think the whole thing's got me just a little bit befuddled that, you know, I'm a kind of a basic, probably better than a basic user, and I know stuff, but when you start getting into these things that are more advanced, or they're changing all the time, I just can't keep up with, okay, what's the best way to do this now? So for me, backups are critical, and because I took this course with you, Chris, those years ago, which was so awesome, but I'm religious with my backups, but now with these new systems, I'm not even sure if I've got a backup at this point. So I don't want to bog down tonight's meeting.
No, that's fine, because I'll point out that one of the things, if you don't understand what's going on with your backup, it is a useless backup, because you have to be able to know that you can recover. And so if you don't know that you can recover, then it's not a useful backup.
That's exactly why I asked the question.
And I continue to evolve the presentation that I give at the Ottawa Public Library. And one of the things we're thinking of doing is coming up with, because the Ottawa Public Library has cut down so much in terms of the number of presentations they've requested from us, we're thinking of maybe putting up a list of all of the presentations that we're willing to give that we typically do give at the Ottawa Public Library, and do it over Zoom for ourselves. And so look for that coming out soon. I know that the backup presentation I give is likely to be one of the popular ones. We'll come out with a list, have some way that people can say, yes, I'm interested, or whatever, and then the more popular ones, we'll look to actually give those over our own Zoom video conference like this. So look for that coming out in the next month or two. And certainly if you want the backup presentation to given, you know, to bring you up to date on it, certainly vote for it at that point in time.
Awesome, thanks.
Okay.
Two things, Chris and Karen. First, Eldon says, you're not alone, Karen, so you're not the only person that has problems with backups. And the second thing is, the next slide is your question about the backup folders or files or whatever they are that you're seeing. So here's a screenshot, and it's producing these files, like, well, it's producing something called desktop WAIEDR7. When you hover the mouse over that, it says that it's an empty folder. Now, I don't use Windows backup systems, so I really don't know what's going on, but I suspect that's actually a disk image file. Does anybody know?
Yeah. I suspect you're right. I'm pretty sure you're right, and desktop would be the name of the computer.
Anybody use Windows backup, and that looks familiar?
No, but I would suspect that empty folder is a erroneous message that may not have as much meaning as we're giving it. How's that?
Yeah, it could be that the backup system is running a system, and that the user doesn't have direct access to the files in there. So it could well be full of files. You just don't have access to them.
Presumably with Windows Backup, you also have Windows Restore. So you should be able to look at that thing somehow and see what it includes.
Well, I'm surprised Chris hasn't mentioned it already, but you know, given what Karen just said, and it does take away from my comment, buy more storage, is that, you know, pick a backup program. I think Chris likes EaseUseS. I like it too. Is that fair, Chris?
Yep.
Okay. And I like it because it is intuitive. Thank you. It would have came to me eventually. The program's intuitive to use. So, you know, EaseUseS, you can get a free version. And if you start using that, it's quite a bit more clear on what you're backing up and what are the contents. And I think, as Chris has mentioned, he's covered off how to use it in the past. I'm betting it's on the OPCUG website. And, yeah. And so that's, given what Karen just said, that I would change my advice to not use Windows Backup, but to use EaseUseS, and then try that and see if it gives you a comfort level that you're looking for that you currently don't have.
I just pasted into the chat the link to the review I did of 4 backup programs, and EaseUS to do backup was one of them. However, it's probably worth reading because I didn't come to the conclusion that any of them were bad. They just have a little bit different feature set and things like that. I know that Alan is a big fan of Macrium Reflect, yeah. And but these the review that I did there that I put in the link, they all have free versions available, so you can try them all out if you want.
That's awesome. Thanks, gentlemen.
Karen, don't go away, because your other question was the same list of files and folders, and there's an odd one at the top, which is an alphanumeric character string. It's an empty folder. Can it be deleted? I think that's probably being produced by Windows Update, and it's a kind of a temporary folder, and it's got lost somehow. If it's empty, my suggestion is it can be deleted. Anybody?
I did a window backup, and I do have a folder that has something on it, and it's called a Windows Image Backup. And then it goes to the name of the desk of the computer, and then followed by backup with the date. So, and then when you open it, at one point, at first it asks, do you really open that folder? So you have to say yes, you want to open it, and then it lets you go through the folders, and you can actually see all the data. Mine is 49 gig, for example.
Right. Yeah, exactly. I don't know if it's empty. And one further thought is to Karen is that pick a backup that Chris has listed, and buy, I hate to say it, but buy another drive if you're unsure. Fill that one up. Make sure you're comfortable with the backup that is currently running with whatever you choose going forward. And then at that point, if you're happy with what you're seeing and you're comfortable with it, then you can start overwriting the drive that you're showing us now. Because to Jocelyn's point, you may be getting an erroneous message due to file permissions or other issues. And Microsoft does do this thing where it says, oh, you don't need to worry about this, so I won't tell you anything more.
By the same token, Lawrence, this desktop file, whatever it is, it doesn't show the little yellow folder icon, like all the other folders in that directory.
Well, I'm seeing a yellow folder icon there.
Next to desktop?
No, not next to that. Well, okay, the one that you have in the red square.
Yeah.
So, we're being asked.
I agree, that's a folder. But what about these desktop files? Those are supposed to be the backups. Highlighted in blue.
I get that. But I don't have enough information to give more details. So I'm not familiar with what's going on. I just know that we shouldn't make too many assumptions. We're not the right, if we don't have someone that knows, then we shouldn't assume, is what I'm basically saying.
Yeah, fair enough.
Yeah, Karen, if you're interested, Karen, touch base with me, and we could do a remote assistant to your computer or a Zoom to your computer, and we could dive a little bit deeper into it and maybe find out a little bit more about what is really there by me actually looking.
Oh, that's really generous, Chris. Thanks very much. And no thank problem. You all. Thank you all for your input. And you're kind of echoing what I've been thinking, but I really didn't want to have to buy another external.
Yeah, so. I don't think we'll have to get to that. We should be able to clean up the existing drive by really investigating what's there and getting rid of stuff that is not needed.
Thank you so much for making so much time for me tonight. That's awesome, everybody, and I will take a look at the link to the backup presentation.
Okay.
You know, Bob Walker here. There's various system cleanup utilities which you should use with extreme caution, but there's ones like Avast Cleanup and System Mechanic. Try and avoid System Mechanic. But they'll go through a lot of these odd files and delete them from the point of view that some of these are remnants of the old system restore point with Windows and other such things that, once you've got one or two system restore points, you don't need any more. And so there's utilities that will clean these out, but you have to be careful about how you use them.
Yeah, I have Advanced IOBit, and I've done some with that, and I've done some CCleaner work. And but when I get these odd ones, I just don't have enough knowledge to know what's actually a Windows-based thing that it's creating for some other purpose that I may or may not know about. And that's when I start getting, that's beyond me.
It's so, good to be cautious.
Yeah, exactly. Even, so thank you all.
Even us experts have that same issue. Programmers throw all sorts of wrenches into things.
One simple test you can do is create a temporary file, do your backup, delete that file, and see if you can restore that file.
And my suggestion on the this 9B48 folder thing, I would make a disk image backup using ESUS or Macrium or something like that. Make a disk image backup. Delete that folder, and if the system crashes, just restore the backup. But my guess is it's going to be fine.
I think you're right.
Nothing. Anyway,
and part
Chris,
of
is going to, Chris is going to take a look, and we'll do a follow-up next week. Right, Chris?
Sure.
Yeah. The other thing is, if this isn't a really big file, who cares? If it's not haunting 10% of your hard drive or whatever, is it really an issue?
Yeah. I mean, there's a certain thing to be said for that, too. Just leave it be if it's not causing a problem. But we'll look and we'll report back.
All right, we've got three more questions, I think. I think they're fairly short.
Yeah, let's keep going.
One is about Word. Is it possible to use two or more languages at the same time in spell and grammar check? Chris?
Yeah, definitely is. From Word 2010 onwards, you can actually have the spell checker detect language automatically, which I'm not sure how it will do things like, if you type in color O-U-R or color O-R, is it going to assume that if you type O-U-R that you're in Canadian English, and if you do C-O-L-O-R that you want to spell check in U.S.? I don't know. So I don't know how good that will be. It may be more useful when you have it detecting, say, French or as opposed to Spanish or something like that. But you can turn that on, and it may help. So you go into the Review tab, go to the Languages group, and click on Language, and then there's an option there for set proofing language and detect language automatically. So you can try that. But you can also mark text as being different languages. And so you can actually select a block of text, and then you can go into the Review tab, Language section, Language, set proofing language, and it'll set it for that block. You can also set it in your template. So in your templates of your documents, you could actually have it default to, you could have a template for French documents and a template for Spanish documents, and you could have it set the language preference automatically because it's coming out of that. So there are a number of things that you can do for multiple languages. Bob, does that answer your question at all?
Yeah, to a certain extent. It'd be, to detect the language, if you look at the list of languages, it's quite extensive.
Yeah.
I'd rather sort of limit that, but the reality is Office 2010 and Word 2010 are soon to be unsupported. And even though I have about 8 licenses for Office 2010, I'm going to have to bite the bullet and buy at least one license for the latest version just so I can do what I need to do on my main computer.
Yeah. Anyhow, that should give you some options.
Okay, next question is, if Windows 10 does minor updates and bug fixes in the background without telling you? And Chris knows the answer to this one.
Well, my understanding is that definitely it can. So I've seen it, and I know from discussions on the MVB forums at Microsoft and things like that, that it definitely can do installations of updates without telling it at all and without a reboot being if a reboot is not required, it can do it. But I don't believe that it always does that. So I think there are times when it tells you that it's going to do an update before it actually does it. But I don't know what the magic sauce is that tells you what updates are going to be done one way versus another. But I've definitely personally experienced both sides of that, where it'll do a silent install of something with no reboot required, and I've also seen where an update didn't get applied until such time as I told it, yes, go ahead and do it. Anybody else have other experiences that they've seen, consistently one way or another?
I disagree with what you said, Chris. Too much magic going on in the background.
Yeah, I mean, it seems to be a flip of the coin almost, what's going to actually happen. It's just that I do know that it can happen where an update will get applied and you don't get notified at all about it. I personally experienced that. So I think Microsoft probably actually does know. It's just it's probably the way that a particular update is packaged that tells it, because they have to be able to package them so that whether a reboot is required or not, because it's not always a matter of whether a file gets replaced that's in use. Sometimes it can be something that changes that fundamentally they do have to restart the operating system in order for that to take effect. And so they do have ways of being able to tell an update that, yes, this requires a reboot, or no, it doesn't. And I presume they also have a way of saying, yes, this will silently install without bugging the user, or we're going to ask the user for permission to do this, or at least let them know that this is the intent, that it's going to actually happen. And how they determine what to do with any particular update, I don't know what the decision process is at all. And I've never gotten anybody at Microsoft who will actually tell me one way or another.
Yeah, Bob Walker here. From the very days when I first got involved in personal computers, back in the DOS days, every once in a while you'd have to restart the damn thing just because things would start to go wonky, and that was the only way you could recover the usefulness of the system. And I've noticed with Windows 10, quite often, I do a reboot, and it cleans things up. Sometimes it cleans things up just because that's the way it works. But other times I suspect that they're sneaking a minor update or bug fix in there without doing the update and shutdown or update and restart option. And that's why I sort of asked this question, because I suspect they're sneaking things in without letting you know about it.
I don't know that they're actually hiding updates to that extent. You should be able to always go into settings, update and security, Windows update, and look at the update history. And that should actually give you all of the updates that happen. What they do sort of hide is when, like the screenshot here, the 2020-09 cumulative update. Well, what's in that? And you can actually look up that KB article number, and it should list all of the things that are fixed in there. So sometimes they're doing silent update. I suspect that what's happening is that when they think that there is no impact to the user and they can do it without a reboot, then they won't tell you. If there's a chance that there would be a change in behavior, but they don't require a reboot, they may still notify you that some update is going to actually occur. And then, of course, if an update, if a reboot is going to be required, they'll notify you of that for sure. But I don't think that they're really doing updates without any sort of notification at all. If you go into the update history, they should all be listed there. And with a KB article number that you can look up and find out what was actually in that particular update.
Yeah, this gets back to the question of what are the parameters for updating one particular computer make and model versus another, because I know that my wife's Microsoft Surface, of five active computers we have, that is always the very, very, very last one to get any Microsoft updates.
Yeah, I find it mind-boggling that Microsoft's own hardware, the Surface hardware, had blocks on it for the 2003 Windows update for months before they finally took all of the blocks off it. I find it really hard to believe that their own hardware, they can't even come out with the drivers and so forth that will allow a successful feature update to Windows. Very strange.
That was a 2004 update, and we're now 2009, and Lenovo machines still haven't got the feature update.
Yeah.
Well, in my world, my oldest, most decrepit machines were the first to get the Windows 2004 update, and the 1909 and the 1903, and the hottest computers that should be the first to get it are always the last to get it, and the very, very last is always the Microsoft Surface.
Okay, question about a solid-state drive, 250 gig with a 2 terabyte hard drive, I guess. Wants to add a second 2 terabyte drive and mirror it. Can we do this through software, or do we have to have a special disk controller? Chris?
I've seen lots of talk about the fact that you should avoid software RAID if possible, that hardware-based RAID is certainly better, and I have no personal experience with running RAID hardware or software, so I really can't comment on that. I've never heard anybody saying that software RAID is better than hardware RAID. You can do software RAID in Windows 10. So if you go to the disk management tool, you right-click on the disk that currently has your data on it, and you choose the pop-up option, add mirror, and then you'll be prompted for the disk you want to mirror that to, and then it'll take care of it from that. So it's definitely possible to do it. I put the link there for the Windows Central article on how to set up mirroring, and it does step-by-step, and it covers all sort of contingencies of whether your drive has data on it already or doesn't have data on it and various things like that, as well as how to recover if one of the drives was to fail, how you get your other mirrored volume up and running. So should have all of the answers in there.
Okay. I'm going to skip over the other questions because there's a different way to ask other questions. We don't have time for that. But we have some upcoming presentations. This guy is going to talk about making blogs and websites using free software, which he loves. And then he's got a second dose about Android phones on October the 14th. That's our regular monthly meeting in October. So if you're interested in Android, that's one to go for. And the final thing, our next Q&A will be next week. And if you do have questions or things that you want to share, then please send it along to our suggestion box email address, and we'll see how we can fit it in.
I think we covered off everything that's in the queue in the chat window. If we actually missed anything, by all means, send it on to the suggestion box, and we'll be sure to cover it next week. But I agree, we're running 15 minutes over right now. I think it was a good evening. I think we had a lot of good information. That sharing of a person's screen, if anybody wants to take advantage of that in the future, if you have a particular problem and it's easier to show it than say it, By all means, consider whether you would like to share your screen to everybody and have everybody input that way. So, do you have anything else, Alan?
No, that's it for me.
Okay.
Thanks, everyone.
Thanks, everyone, for attending. I think it was a really good session. We'll get the audio up there by tomorrow, along with the deck posted to the website. We'll see you all next week.
Thank you.